Welcome to In My Backyard, an open conversation about children and mental health. We all know a child who's struggling, whether that child tells us or not. In this podcast, we speak with experts on the many factors of emotional distress in children, how to address those factors, and how to create a community where all children can be healthy and happy. This podcast is made possible through generous donations from supporters and listeners like you. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club to become a monthly donor today. Your host is Tricia Costales, CEO of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California.
I'm Tricia Costales, your host of In My Backyard. I'm a licensed clinical social worker and the chief executive officer of the Guidance Center, a nonprofit children's mental health agency serving 3,500 children and families every year. On today's episode, we're going to explore together whether there is a link between mental illness and mass killings, a tragic phenomenon that is relatively unique to the United States. According to the Center for Disease Control, 48,830 people died from gun-related injuries in the United States in 2021, the last year for which data is available. The Pew Research Center reports that though they tend to get less public attention than gun-related murders, suicides have long accounted for the majority of U.S. gun deaths, at roughly 54%, compared to 43% attributed to murder. It's difficult to parse out the number of these gun deaths that are attributable to mass shootings because, as Pew Research Center reports, there's no single agreed-upon definition of the term mass shooting. The FBI defines a mass shooting as active shooter incidents, or one or more individuals actively engaged in killing or attempting to kill people in a populated area. Other sources, including the Gun Violence Archive, define a mass shooting more broadly as incidents where four or more people are shot, even if there are no fatalities. It can also be difficult to track trends because there are outlier events that skew data. The Las Vegas attack in 2017, where more than 50 people were killed, 500 wounded, and countless more traumatized, is one example of an outlier that would skew data. Regardless of how the numbers are tracked, and it is striking that despite the numbers of deaths, there's still no uniformity of definition, it is clear that active shooting incidents have become more common in the United States over the years. Even with their conservative tracking methodology, the FBI notes steadily increasing trends over time since the year 2000. It is clear that we have a problem in the United States. Never before have children had to undergo active shooter trainings in the classroom. We didn't used to fear mass shootings while shopping, going to work or the movies, or taking our little ones to elementary schools. These fears have a real impact on the national psyche. Again and over again, after yet another mass shooting, we hear a causal attribution to mental illness. The National Council for Behavioral Health wrote in 2019, "After mass shootings, political leaders often invoke mental illness as the reason for mass violence, a narrative that resonates with the widespread public belief that mentally ill individuals in general pose a danger to others. Since it is difficult to imagine that a mentally healthy person would deliberately kill multiple strangers, it's commonly assumed that all perpetrators of mass violence must be mentally ill." As a mental health expert and advocate, I struggle with this. The United States doesn't have higher rates of mental illness than our international counterparts, but we have substantially higher rates of mass shootings. It seems sometimes to be a uniquely American problem that can't be attributed to mental illness alone. But is there a correlation? Today we have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Jack Rozelle. Dr. Rozelle is a doctor of emergency and forensic psychiatry at the University of Pittsburgh, with an expertise in threat management and violence prevention. A distinguished fellow of the American Psychiatric Association, Dr. Roselle has served as incident commander for mass shootings and been involved in the behavioral health response to several mass casualty events. He contributed to major policy and practice efforts, including the National Council for Behavioral Health's 2019 report on mass violence, the National Suicide Prevention Lifeline's Violence Management Guidelines, and Pennsylvania Governor's Special Counsel on Gun Violence report. Welcome, Dr. Roselle, or Jack. You first came to my attention when I attended your workshop on mass violence at the 2023 National Council for Behavioral Health, and I found it fascinating. I immediately emailed my staff and said, I want to talk to this guy. So for my benefit and for our listeners, would you please say a few words about yourself?
Sure. My name's Jack Roselle. I am the medical director of Resolve Crisis Services, which is a part of UPMC Medical Center out here in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. And we handle the community-based crisis and emergency mental health stuff for the greater Pittsburgh region. And ultimately, I spend about half my life doing emergency mental health in one way, shape, or form, and about half my life doing violence and violence prevention work. And as you can imagine, there's a pretty big interface between those two places.
So could you please tell us a little bit about your role there. And I'd read in your bio that you're an incident commander for mass shootings. And what does all that mean?
Well, so through my emergency mental health role and through my own background and training as a child and forensic psychiatrist, I spend a lot of time doing things like responding and supporting people after major violent incidents, whether it is sort of that day-to-day toll of community violence, whether it's more high-profile types of events, and that's even included, you know, roles in disaster response and mass casualty incidents as an incident commander. And, you know, over the years, I've realized that, you know what, I'm pretty good at recognizing and managing acute and post-traumatic stress disorder. I've worked with a lot of first responders, a lot of community members, a lot of kids, a lot of families who've lost people to gun violence. And you learn pretty quickly that as valuable as that work is, finding a way to prevention is a lot more rewarding and a lot more engaging for me.
Now, you started out your workshop at NatCon, and even in the write-up about it, you wrote that most mass violence is not due to mental illness or people with mental illness. Could you speak more to that?
So turn on the news, go to your social media sources after whatever awful tragedy it is today or this week, and you'll see these common themes in the rhetoric and in the discourse out there. And one of the very common ones is, it must have been a person with, you know, sometimes it's that whispered that with mental illness, right? You know, this idea that no rational person could have committed such a terrible, awful act, right? The reality is when you really peel back the layers and look at this, when you go to the research that's out there, it's pretty clear that the vast majority of violence, including the vast majority of gun violence and the majority of mass violence, whether it's gun-related or otherwise, isn't causally tied back to psychiatric illness, right? So if we, you know, I always say if we snapped our fingers and all the psychiatric illness that's out there, just poof, goes away, right? Which would be wonderful. I'd be thrilled with that. It'd change my job description a little bit.
But so mine be it. Too.
But, you know, that would be wonderful. And it would move the dial for general violence, maybe 5 to 10%. Our best estimates for mass violence, mass shootings, it might move the dial 20%, maybe 30 or 40%. But the reality is when we dive into it, again, most of the assailants of these high-profile, headline-grabbing tragedies aren't people living with what we would think of as a significant or severe psychiatric illness. And even when they are, figuring out the causality, generally there's no indication of causality, right? Just, you know, living with a psychiatric illness doesn't mean being defined by it, whether our actions are for good or for otherwise.
So I want to push back on that a little bit, if I may. Like, I read the CDC's post-mortem report on the shooter who killed those babies at Sandy Hook. And he clearly had mental health issues that were not being addressed. It was infuriating to me to read that report. Like, there was so much that was missed. Or the Parkland shooter, who clearly had a history of trauma. Or that Aurora movie theater shooter, who presents as psychotic in his court appearances. How do they fit in then?
Yeah, and to be clear, some of these folks, they're pretty ill. Part of it is that the media pays more attention to cases where there seems to be evidence of mental illness. We have some interesting research that backs that up. But again, remember, there's a difference between correlation and causation, right? Everybody who breathes dies. That's correlation. Everybody who does not breathe dies. That's often causation, right? And what we know when we look at a lot of these incidents is that sometimes it's people engaging in violence, not because of the psychiatric illness, but despite the mental illness, right? So that's one layer of it. The second thing is trauma is significant. Trauma is common, but it's certainly not dispositive. And emphatically, the vast majority of people who live with psychiatric illness are not violent, not towards themselves, not towards anyone else. We're talking about these sort of rare, extraordinary circumstances. And again, some of these folks, they're pretty ill. But also, some of these folks actually did encounter mental health professionals sort of over and over again in various ways, shapes, and forms. And the mental health professionals who laid eyes on those people said, there may be mental health stuff going on, or there may not be mental health stuff going on, but it's not causally linked to violence risk, right? They're not saying, this is someone that is ill enough, is dangerous enough in a way that we might hospitalize them or involuntarily intervene. These are people that may just be living with symptoms, may have a history of trauma, may have a history of stressors, but, right there at the time aren't, acutely impaired by it, right? Again, not everything about a person is defined by the diagnosis. And if any of these events were easy enough to explain just with one diagnosis, then it would actually, it would be a lot easier to manage. It would be a lot easier to reduce the risk.
So we know, we've all read those reports too. We know as mental health professionals that most people with mental illness don't ever commit violence. And in fact, they're more likely to be victims of violence than perpetrators. Yeah. So if the causal factor isn't mental illness, what are the risk factors? What would make somebody go kill random strangers?
So one of the things I say, and one of the things that the research supports, is it's never just one thing. If this was simple enough to explain in a soundbite, we would have fixed it by now, right? These are layers upon layers of risk factors that accumulate in certain people for various and sundry reasons. And sometimes, psychiatric illness, maybe not even severe psychiatric illness, but just maybe a little bit of impairment might play a factor. But again, the evidence is most of the time for most of the assailants, it's not present or it doesn't play a causative role, right? So sometimes it's there. So we don't begin just looking at people with mental illness. What we want to do is we want to begin by looking at people who've given us fairly concrete indications that they're at risk for violence. So they've either done something that indicates that they're working their way towards a violent act. They've acquired lots of weapons. They've communicated in some way saying, hey, I want to go engage in violence, right? You mentioned the assailant at Marjory Stoneman Douglas, who fairly notoriously had posted online, I'm going to be a professional school shooter, under his own name. It wasn't subtle. It wasn't mysterious. There were often when we see these incidents, we see this leakage in advance. And if we identify that early on, we can do something with it, right? So we're starting off for that behavior. Like someone's, again, accumulating weapons, putting together a plan. They're communicating to someone that they want to engage in violence. And it might be very direct. Hey, I'm going to kill you, right? And that target hears that threat. It might be a little bit more indirect. Hey, I don't want to see you hurt. Maybe you stay home from work tomorrow, right? I've got that performance eval with my boss. It's just for your, it's a good time for you to take a PTO day, right? Say, that's information we got to do something with, right? And sometimes it's postings online through social media or other ways. And if people hear that, if they recognize that, and they have someone who they trust and are comfortable handing that information off to, whether it's an HR rep, whether it's a coworker, whether it's someone in the school setting, say, hey, I heard so-and-so make this comment, and it's concerning. The idea is that we want them to hand that information off to someone who has the knowledge, skills, and expertise to do something with it, right? I don't expect the random employee. I don't expect the eighth grader on the school bus. I don't expect the clergy member out in their house of worship to be a subject matter expert on threat management. But I expect them to recognize that, ooh, that's significant, and realize they've got to hand it off to someone, again, who they trust and who can reliably follow up on it.
So you're talking about sort of behavioral indicators there.
Yeah.
That we could all look for as red flags. Are there characterological risks?
There are, but, you know, they're not necessarily terribly consistent, right? So, for example, we think about psychopathy, right? You know, it's sort of the personality disorder that everybody knows except the writers of the DSM, right? But, you know, we have a rough idea of what it is, right? In fact, when you sit down and do detailed assessments of people who engage in violence or mass violence, when we look at people who are in prisons for violent crimes, most of them aren't psychopaths. And in fact, most psychopaths don't necessarily do something that egregious to get themselves into trouble. But if they have all those other risk factors and they happen to be a psychopath, you know, the gloves come off, right? The brakes go away, and the magnitude and severity of what they might do can be significantly higher. But problems with anger, problems with feeling outed, ostracized, separated from others, not outed in the traditional LGBT sense, but that they're being sort of pushed away and excluded and mistreated and wronged. We talk about this idea of people who get fixated on grudges and grievances, right? You know, and as a clinician, you know, we've all had the experience. Someone comes into the office and says, ah, it all started going wrong when I was in eighth grade, right? And if they're in 10th grade, yeah, okay, that's one type of interview. If they're my age and I'm about to relay to you like everything that's happened to me over the past, you know, 35 plus years of my life and all the different ways people have hurt me and wronged me and mistreated me and discriminated against me, we know it's a very different interview. And to be clear, sometimes some of those grievances are legitimate, and sometimes the best intervention to reduce someone's risk is to say, ooh, that happened to you. I'm really sorry that happened to you. You're right. That shouldn't have happened to you. And if it's within our power to fix or remediate that, we should try and do that, right? But we also know that there's some folks, and, you know, the old psychoanalyst talked about sort of this idea of moral masochism or the grievance collector of people who just sort of become defined as a person who's wronged by society. And it gets tricky, but finding a way to work with that to help them, you know, better deal with that before they get to the point and say, you know what, I can start hurting people the way they've hurt me, because that's when I really start to get concerned.
These risk factors, those people that have anger management issues, those people who hold on to those grudges so tightly, that's not unique to the United States.
Absolutely not.
And mass killings aren't entirely unique to us, but it does seem a whole lot more common here. I mean, apart from guns, apart from that sort of obvious answer, you know, you could do it with a car, too, if you wanted to.
Yeah.
Why does it happen so often here relative to other places?
Well, to be clear, part of it is firearm-related, right? And it's firearm access-related. Emphatically, the vast majority of firearm owners are lawful, responsible, safe, and as intensely passionate about reducing firearm injury and reducing these types of terrible community events as everyone else is, right? There's, you know, gun ownership is normal. And also, here we are in the United States with more guns than the next 39 countries combined, according to some of the data sets that are out there. And so it's fair to say this may play a role, right? But also it plays a role in ways that people don't necessarily expect, right? Yes, you know, AR style or, you know, assault style rifles do play an oversized role in some of the highest mortality and morbidity events. And also, overall, when we look at all mass shootings, actually don't play a role in that many of them. Most of them are handguns. And that just reflects most of the guns that are out in civilian hands are handguns, right? But what are the other things beyond the guns, right? Why is it America? Well, people like to point their fingers at, it's psychiatric illness, or it's a lack of psychiatric services, right? So we get this from both sides, right? So there's a bunch of people that say, ah, that person was psychiatrically ill. You mental health professionals should have been doing more, right? And again, if they're offering money for more psychiatric care, I think you and I are both there in line with some great evidence-based, compassionate ways to spend that money.
Happy to provide more services, yes.
Yep. But we ain't going to move the dial that far, right? When you look at the United States compared to lots of other economically developed countries, our psychiatric illness rates aren't that different. Our psychiatric treatment rates aren't that different. Every country has opportunities for improvement. We certainly have opportunities for improvement. But we don't think that would shift the dial that much. Well, then we get it from the other side. It's not the lack of psychiatric treatment. It's not that this person was psychiatrically ill and we missed that opportunity to hospitalize them indefinitely, and then we can have a whole separate discussion about psychiatric hospitalization and some of those myths. But we get it from anti-psychiatry groups like the Scientologists saying, it was your medications, it was the antidepressants, that's what caused it. And oh, by the way, there's a few folks out there who say, it was the vaccinations that did it. Well, and thoroughly and repeatedly debunked, right? It's just not a true thing. It is overwhelmingly and abundantly clear that psychiatric medications do not cause serious acts of violence. In fact, we've got some really interesting data out there that says when we look at people who engage in violence, who already, who have high risk factors, who are involved in the criminal justice system, the ones who are receiving medications and who stay on their medications are the ones least likely to engage in violence, right? So whatever we can do to support adherence, not saying that all violence is tied to mental illness, but when you do have that intersection of a lot of violence risk and significant mental health issues, supporting them so they can successfully stay on medications can help reduce their future risks, right? So again, we know it's not psychiatric stuff. We know it's not video games, right? We know it's not movies and media and TV, folks, you know, all, you know, Squid Game, right? Very violent thing. Guess what, folks? Did not come from the U.S., right? Violence in movies is not a new thing, you know? Spoiler warning, pretty much every Disney film has some terrible thing happening to a parent. Like, you know, again, spoiler warning, Bambi's mom dies in like the first minutes of the film. This is nothing new, and it's absolutely nothing distinct to what's happening in the United States, right? But we have a lot of other things that add a lot of stressors to the lives of Americans, which again, we see in other countries. We have a lot of opportunities to improve the social safety net. But one of the things that may make the United States a little bit different is we have the history, right? And, you know, one of the things we always say, one of the best predictors of future behavior is past behavior. Certainly not a guarantee, and it's not prophecy or set in stone. But when we have a culture where for decades now, it's just this story after the story after the story after the story, when we have a generation of children raised in K-12 school settings where every aspect of their life is disrupted around, oh my gosh, there might be a school shooter. And rather than, you know, enacting other precautions, we're going to put the kids through sometimes poorly designed and very traumatizing exercises and drills and so forth. What we're doing is we're teaching people that when you're pissed off, this is one of the things you can do. When you're pissed off and you feel like people aren't paying attention to you, this is one of the ways that people hear your name, right? And it's not the only factor, but it's one factor. It's complicated, but we know that there's, you know, there's some issues around acceleration of behavior, of copycat behavior when we have highly covered incidents.
So in some ways, that it's become part of our culture?
I think so. Is there good, you know, empirical high-level data on this? Of course not. But I can tell you, again, I can tell you the things that we've ruled out, right? It's not significantly because of media or video games or access or lack of access to mental health treatment. And it's a lot of little things that add up. And media and the way, you know, America sort of embraced this combined with, you know, access to, you know, ways to really hurt lots of people increases the frequency of some of these events. If we're talking about a lot of very rare risk factors. A lot of very risk factors that are actually common in folks, but they line up in very rare patterns. Mm-hmm. And when you have that added to ready access of ways to hurt lots of other people very quickly, things get bad.
It can feel kind of relentless sometimes. Yeah. I grew up partially in another country, and sometimes I feel like I should just leave. I'm done. I believe that to some degree we make it, you know, it has become such a big thing in our culture that, you know, it's probably rarer than it feels, but it does keep happening. And even though it's rarer than it feels, we haven't been effective at stopping it. So what are we missing as parents, as educators, as mental health professionals, as neighbors? What are we missing?
Right. And so first of all, you're right. There's something about these stories that pull our attention, right? You know, our brains probably evolved in a way to say, if there's something scary and intense out there, we pay a lot of attention to it, right? You know, if it's 50,000 years ago and we're, you know, walking, you know, to the oasis, you know, in a desert somewhere, you know, we pay more attention to the lion than we do to the parrot up in the trees, right? We're wired to think about dangerous stuff. I've been thinking recently, it kind of goes back to, you know, I don't know if you know the old Henny Youngman joke that he was famous for, of like, so someone says, you know, hey, Henny, you know, how's your wife? And his answer is, well, compared to what, right? So how bad is the gun violence or the mass violence problem? Well, compared to what, right? Compared to other economically developed countries, gun violence in the U.S., it's pretty bad. You know, more than something like 98% of the school-age children who are murdered by firearms in economically developed countries are American kids. That's a problem. More than 93% of the women murdered by firearms in economically developed countries are American women. That's a problem, especially when we're maybe 30% of that population, right? And also, our rates of death from other preventable illnesses, opioid overdoses and other drug overdoses, obesity and cardiac health and all these other things, they're all very significant as well. And we lose more people to drug overdoses than we do to gun violence. So it's a problem. We've got to be thoughtful about how we allocate resources around it. And I completely forgot what the original question was, and I apologize.
What are we missing? What are we missing? Right. Your tangent was fascinating, so don't apologize.
So what are we missing, right? So how do we give resources to this significant problem in a way that is reasonable, does not inflate fear, and actually fixes the underlying issue, right? For the listeners who have firearms or grew up around firearms, they've almost certainly heard the adage that before you point your gun at something, before you put your finger on the trigger, make sure that you're ready to destroy whatever you're aiming it at and whatever might be behind it, right? You know your target and what's behind it before you pull the trigger. In some ways, public health is kind of the same way, right? Know your target and what predictable potential consequences might be before you enact your intervention, right? Policymakers watch the same dumb pundits on TV that the rest of us suffer through and see some of the same dumb stuff on social media that the rest of us see and unfortunately get influenced by some of that, right? So they focus on big, scary things and ways that might not necessarily fix the underlying issue, right? So the example I come back to are schools. And to be very clear, I've got a little girl at home. She's 10. She's headed into the fifth grade. I love the idea that she has a safe school. I treasure that. I value that. But she also needs a safe home and a safe community, a safe place to go play with her friends, a safe way to sort of get back and forth. If we stopped all the firearm homicides that occur in U.S. schools, and again, this is CDC data going back over like 20 years, maybe 1.5, slightly shy of 2% of all firearm homicide deaths of school-age kids, K-12 kids, happened in the school setting. Most of it happens outside. most of the school shootings aren't someone going in and trying to do terrible things to lots of people. It's kid A goes in looking for kid B and says, hey, so-and-so, I'm pissed off at you, pops off a few shots, and then runs like hell, right? Lots of the school shootings aren't actually within the four corners of the building itself. It's not happening while the kids are have their butts in seats in the classroom. They're outside waiting for the bus. They're coming and going from school. It's an athletic event. It's, the Friday night lights becoming Friday night fights. So if we're going to come up with a tool to keep our kids of that age safe, yeah, a metal detector might sort of help if you staff people around that metal detector, if you're prepared to deal with the fact that you're going to have a big queue of very vulnerable folks waiting to go through that metal detector, and realize that's going to cost a lot of money. It's going to take a lot of staff time, and it's not going to do anything really clear one way or the other to your school culture. And there's actually not a lot of evidence that'll reduce it. But, you know, if you're in a community where lots of folks walk around with guns, it might keep a few guns from getting inside if you're using them and using them properly. And you'll still have the vast majority of the firearm deaths of your students to deal with, right? So we've got to think about sort of what's going to work, right? Stuff that focuses on post-incident response. Stop the bleed. Stop the bleed saves lives. I have sat with the survivors myself. I have seen it work. We know this. Run, hide, fight works. We've seen this over and over again, that the people who run survive often, right? Sometimes good people with guns, not as often as people think, but sometimes having the good people with guns around might impede or stop someone else from opening fire. But all of those things sort of require someone to open fire for it to be useful, right? Stop the bleed doesn't start working until someone's bleeding. My approach, I'm a doctor, it's nice when people don't bleed, right? Preventing the bleeding is generally seen as a good thing, right? So can we prevent? Can we get upstream? Can we get left of bang, as we say in military and operational settings, right? And so finding ways to identify people at risk and reducing their risk is a very good tool. We call that behavioral threat assessment and management. Sometimes that involves things like behavioral health interventions, sometimes involves legal interventions, but often it involves social interventions. Housing, social supports, community engagement, finding peers and connections. Sometimes it involves things like extreme risk protective orders, where for that one person for a period of time, we're going to restrict their access to firearms. But we don't think about, like, let's make broad social changes around this stuff. We focus on that one person of interest. Improving education and awareness about what are the warning signs. Improving the safety nets so that when someone does hear that concerning statement in their workplace, online, in the community, in their house of worship, they know who to hand it off to, and that person can get it to the right type of skilled, trained team to take it from there.
So you brought us to this next question and hinted at it a bit, but you did talk about threat management in your workshop. Yeah. And very specifically, could you tell us what that means and how that works?
So behavioral threat assessment and management, sometimes you'll hear us say BTAM. It's like the best kept secret in evidence-based violence prevention. It is a model that has been around. It dates back to at least to the 1980s when the LAPD, who were managing stalking, harassment, and threats against some of the celebrities out there on the West Coast, started talking with some of the folks in Washington, D.C., who were dealing with threats, harassment, and stalking of elected officials, of, Supreme Court judges, et cetera. And they started communicating and saying, hey, we're dealing with the same issues. We're trying to pull together some data. And it built from there. And what we now have is a data set or a body of knowledge that reflects many, many, many academic centers, many law enforcement partners, many different disciplines, from behavioral sciences to clinical behavioral health, to medical settings, to law enforcement, to intelligence, and all these other areas coming together and saying, hey, look, we have an approach that helps us recognize some people, not everyone, but some people before they engage in acts of violence. And it gives us a toolkit of interventions that can really reduce their risk, or at least help us monitor them for in different ways, help us come up with some rational ways to contain and reduce their risks. But sometimes to actually substantially reduce the risk, not by putting handcuffs on them or hospitalizing them, but by helping them. And this is a model that has endorsements in one way, shape, or form from any number of organizations. You know, we met at the National Council for Mental Wellbeing. They keep rebranding, I lose track, at their meeting. And, you know, they had a major report that came out a few years ago. We're working on updating that report. And one of our primary recommendations around reducing not just mass violence, but all violence, is behavioral threat assessment and management. Because it's a tool that works across scales. It works really nicely for the person who's thinking, I'm really pissed off about getting laid off, about getting fired, and so I'm going back, and I'm going to go for numbers. And it also works really nicely for the person who's sitting there thinking, I'm so mad at my neighbor. They keep throwing leaves over the backyard fence, you know, or it works really well for the person who maybe is a product of a psychotic illness, has a delusional fixation on someone. It works well across scale and settings. And when it's done right, it's non-discriminatory. When it's done right, it actually reduces some of the racial biases that are out there and already sort of built in, unfortunately, to some of our healthcare and law enforcement systems. And when we do it right, we're not just stopping the bad event, but we're actually helping people and improving their lives. So it's not just that I've stopped, you know, that signal of violence, but no, I've actually taken this person who's really struggling, and I've helped them get a job, I've helped them get a social support network, and that's what ended up reducing their risk.
You know, we had a client recently as a child serving agency. He was a middle school student and found that there was a credible threat. This child had access to guns. He had a kill list in his backpack. Yeah. And we discovered that in the end, we addressed it via partnership with us, the school, law enforcement. But it was really scary as a community-based provider. We were unsure if the family were really partnering with us. We were unsure if they were really willing to lock up those guns. The child's doing well now, so we were able to be effective. But it was terrifying. Yeah. So, you know, what's your advice to mental health agencies like the Guidance Center out there serving kids who could potentially be at risk?
So a couple layers to this. And let me preface this by saying, think of this as best practices and aspirational goals. And I'm not necessarily speaking to what the standard of care may or may not be, right? So I don't want someone to feel like, oh my gosh, we're not doing that, and now we're toast, right? But these are some things to think about, right? Appreciating full on, again, as a medical director of a mental health service, I appreciate we have a lot of constraints on our work and what our teams can and can't do and the time we have for training, all these other things, right? But ongoing education of sort of this is the latest evidence and science around understanding violence risk and managing violence risk, especially through the lens of behavioral threat assessment and management, I think can be invaluable to help people recognize and know what to do. Again, I don't need every therapist, every peer support, you know, every frontline clinician to be a subject matter in behavioral threat assessment management, but I need them to be able to do sort of the first 10 minutes, say, aha, this is really concerning. We need to bring in someone else to consult on this, right? And so then part of this is, you know, agencies and teams should find ways to network and partner with other potential stakeholders. Sometimes this comes organically, right? This is the law enforcement agency or the school resource officer that we've already worked through a couple of cases on. So instead of waiting for that, you know, anxious call at 10 o'clock at night to come through the next time about, you know, scary situation blank, why don't we say, hey, let's go meet for coffee. Let's have lunch. Let's just have a Teams call and start thinking about how we can be a little bit more proactive about this stuff. Figuring out who the people are in your community who are already doing this type of work. There's lots of great threat management professionals across the country. And especially out in California, we have some of the best of the best of the best out there. sometimes that means for larger agencies partnering with major law enforcement centers, either regional law enforcement, federal law enforcement. The Federal Bureau of Investigation is very invested in helping their local branch offices and resident agencies build up partnerships with local mental health providers and others who have an interest in threat management. And part of this is education for the people we care for, whether it's the identified patient or their family member, so they know, hey, look, there's this resource, there are these supports out there. There's this thing out there, it's called threat management. If you see something, say something. And when we're doing it right, it's not a scary process, but we want that kid or that family member to know that if the kid hears something, they should be comfortable raising their hand. And B, we need to do everything we can to make sure that when that kid does raise their hand, the system responds in a healthy, positive way and doesn't go after the kid who makes the report or the family member who makes the report, and is taking a constructive approach to helping that person at risk, and not just trying to slam the cuffs on them or expel them or something like that.
Right.
So, right.
Not disciplinary, but treatment.
Yes. Well, prevention. Right? The goal is prevention. And sometimes that means we might have to rethink some of the other rules. Zero tolerance should mean that we investigate everything, but it shouldn't mean that we punish everything the same way. There's a big difference between someone who brings a gun into the workplace and someone who shoots a rubber band off their finger in the workplace, right? Both of them may require some kind of supervision or discussion, but probably not the same intervention.
So if we know how to make it stop, and from what you're saying, we do, not perfectly, but
yeah,
why aren't we doing more of it?
Yeah, right. So I think of this as a layer of Swiss cheese, right? This is one added layer of protection. Nothing will be perfect. And oh, by the way, if we had perfect knowledge of everything that drives mass violence or targeted violence right here, right now, as we're chatting this afternoon, tomorrow it wouldn't be enough, because the people we're trying to stop are learning too. And part of what they're doing is they're adaptive and intentional and thinking, oh, out there is, Trisha and her treatment team over at the guidance center. And they don't want me to engage in this thing. So I've got to be careful that when they ask me these things, I do something different. I work my way around. So there's never going to be perfect knowledge. But if we have these tools, why aren't we using them more? Well, several federal agencies, the Department of Homeland Security, it's the Center for Prevention Programs and Partnerships, actually have competitive grant funding, substantial grant funding available to develop these types of programs. There have been a couple boluses of federal dollars related to reducing violence in different sectors that are available for this, and from the Department of Justice, from the Department of Education. Again, the Federal Bureau of Investigation has some initiatives where they're working with all their local offices to sort of develop their social network, if you will, of behavioral health professionals. But also part of it's awareness. A lot of times I'll go in and I'll talk with policy leaders and they haven't heard of it or they haven't heard much about it. And usually once they start to hear a little bit about it, they're completely open to it. Again, this is not about broad manipulations of people's civil rights or civil liberties. This is about identifying those specific individuals, the specific dangerous people, and to help them in the least coercive ways that are practical and possible. And usually that's a pretty easy sell. But again, it takes some money, it takes some resources. And it also takes a way to sell it in a way that it's tricky, right? So, all right, a couple years ago, I am at this fundraiser for healthcare in our area, and I am there to basically go hawking for donations to our crisis center. And I had this nice table set up with this little drape over it that says Resolve Crisis. We were called Resolve Crisis Network at the time, and I had cards, and I had pins, and I had some brochures, and I think we might have even had like something standing up behind it to sort of say this is what we do. And I'm there to sort of say, hey, this is what we're doing. And I was right next to the neonatal intensive care transport team. And they had this high-tech $100,000 ICU bassinet that you can that fits into their helicopter. And they had videos, and they were in their flight suits and uniforms, and the helmets people could try on. And they had the bassinet there that was making beeps and pops and noises. And I
and it's babies. You yes. can't fight. It's babies.
Yeah, right. And so in the world of violence prevention, in the world of threat management, I want a bunch of folks to sit around the table and collaborate and find ways to help people. And I think that's a really wonderful thing. And if you are the person with the wallet, whether you are the school board, whether you're the county council, whether you're the state legislature, and you put me coming in and saying, hey, I want a bunch of folks to sort of sit around in a room and find ways to creatively collaborate to help people out to prevent violence. And you have someone coming in with the lights and noises popping, you know, fancy metal detector with the AI enhanced video camera that can recognize weapons and for some reason seems to use blockchain because that's the term of the week. You know,
yeah.
The part of our brain that basic reptile brain that gets attracted to shiny objects goes, ooh, you know, blinking light, right? The threat management folks sort of get lost in the shuffle.
It's not as sexy, is it? It's just not.
Yeah, yeah. So
that's depressing, but I still end these conversations on hope. That's sort of how I roll, and I do believe in mental health. We have to remember that there is hope. That's why we do this work, right? So, what gives you the hope amidst all this trauma? You're working with the survivors. You're fighting against the bright lights of the. Yeah. Incubator. What gives you the hope to keep doing this? What are the bright sides for you?
A couple things. One is I've seen this approach work time and time again. And we never know with any given individual how likely they were or were not. But I've seen the folks who've gone from having the manifestos, having the weapons, having the map and route and plan of attack to writing thank you notes to their therapists, to being completely redirected in their course of life. I've seen people going from being neo-Nazis to being engaged in DEI work. And I've seen some of the most intelligent, compassionate, and creative professionals working on this problem to try and find better solutions. So these are the things that sort of bring me hope. These are the things that sort of keep me at the table. You know, as I'm talking to you right now, I'm in Pittsburgh, and probably about 4 miles as the crow flies are the studios for our local public television station, which is where Mr. Rogers was filmed. And one of Mr. Rogers' lines is, you know, about sort of what do you do when bad things are happening and sort of how do you reframe it, especially for kids. And his line is, you know, look for the helpers. There's scary and bad stuff out there. Is it more frequent than it should be? Yeah. Is it as frequent as it could be? Thankfully, no. But there's a lot of bright, talented, passionate, good people working to find better and safer solutions.
Thank you. It was actually an inspirational answer. I really appreciate that and appreciate your time today. But even more importantly, you know, it takes a lot to dive into this kind of work. And this is real crisis work. And I just thank you for doing it.
Thank you. It's been a delight to be with you. And I hope this is useful for your audience. So,
absolutely. Thank you. It's my position that by shining a light on these issues, admitting that they are in our own backyards, it will be easier for a struggling child to get some help. Ideally, we can all begin to be kinder and more supportive of each other.
In My Backyard is brought to you by the Guidance Center, a children's mental health agency in Long Beach, California. In My Backyard is produced by Tricia Costales and Matthew Murray. Thank you to J. Vincent B. for original music. All other music licensed through Soundstripe. Thank you to our listeners and supporters. Please visit tgclb.org or text HOPE to 562-262-5689 to make a one-time donation or join our Hope and Healing Club To become a monthly donor today, subscribe to In My Backyard on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.